One of my sayings is if you're in a really, really, really big market, you should be able to find at least one person that's willing to buy the product before you have it even built, before you've written even a line of code. Oftentimes I see so many startups that write a ton of code, have a really well-built, fully featured product that no one wants to use, or that they didn't properly validate, or they're saying things to themselves like, if I just built this one feature, someone will come and use it. And the reality is like, look, if you're building in a very large market, if you build a really great business, the VCs will come to you. I've seen some like great businesses with, you know, great founders who maybe, you know, aren't like the best at maybe pitching their company or fundraising. And, you know, VCs will still hand them giant checks because they have a freaking amazing product. You have to constantly, you know, be looking for product market fit, talking to customers. That, you know, journey never really ends. You know, if you're building a, you know, long lasting enduring company, you might have product market fit with a certain market. Like maybe that market is like the first $1 million of business that you have. And now you have to figure out, how do I get to 10 mil? How do I get to 100 mil? And there will be fundamental shifts, you know, in your product, in your ICP, that you will have to expand, you know, over time to better serve that market, right?
Welcome to The Peel, where we explore the world's greatest startup stories. I'm your host, Turner Novak, founder of Nana Capital, a venture capital firm that never stops helping you find product market fit. Today, we're sitting down with my friend, Shrav Mehta, founder and CEO of SecureFrame. Regular listeners of the show are probably familiar with SecureFrame and know that I'm an investor in the company. Today, we're going deep on how SecureFrame is automating the $80 billion compliance market, how Shrav first came up with the idea, and how they got the very first customers. Shrav also shares why finding product market fit never actually ends, his lessons learned hiring and scaling teams, his tactics for uncovering negative feedback and reference checks, tricks for sending a good cold email, and how he has a secret supplier for discount office furniture. Shrav and I haven't caught up in a few months, and I actually learned about a new SecureFrame product while we were recording that you'll hear about too. I always love talking to Shrav, and I'm glad we got to record this. I think you're going to learn a lot, so let's jump in.
Shrav, how's it going?
Good, good. Thanks for having me, Turner.
Yeah, a long time coming. Can you just give us just like a high level on what is compliance, what's SOC 2, all that kind of stuff, and then we'll kind of go a little bit deeper?
The whole security and compliance space has existed for a long time in, you know, different forms. What SecureFrame really does is we help organizations achieve and maintain compliance with, you know, standards such as NIST, ISO 27001, SOC 2, really kind of any, you know, privacy or security framework out there. And today, you know, we work with almost 3,000 customers and innovative, you know, companies like NASDAQ, Lyra Health, Remote, to basically help them get compliant with these frameworks. Oftentimes, you know, might have a customer that says, hey, we need to verify that your security, you know, has some basic, you know, things set up. So, you know, SOC 2 is a very popular, you know, framework that a lot of startups and technology companies comply with. And it might, you know, say, hey, you need to make sure that all your, you know, servers are encrypted at rest and in transit. And SecureFrame will basically connect to your AWS, your Google Cloud, your Azure to automatically, you know, check that's happening. We'll help you, you know, manage your risk, put together your InfoSec policies, and a whole bunch more to help you, you know, meet the requirements of some of these frameworks and, of course, continuously monitor them.
So specifically on the SOC 2, like AWS monitoring, maybe why is that a big deal just for someone who is not familiar with this?
Companies, you know, when you're buying a piece of software, you're going to go through some sort of procurement process, and there's going to be a security team that's involved in reviewing your vendor. Because oftentimes, you know, your weakest link is the vendor that maybe has like the least security that you end up using and maybe sending sensitive information to. So these security processes that companies have in procurement are, you know, quite important. And historically, you know, you'd send out a, you know, security questionnaire, and sometimes these are like, you know, tons of pages long and they can take hours to fill out. And it's kind of like all self-attested, right? You know, if someone says, hey, is everything encrypted at rest in transit? You just answer yes. And sometimes these folks, you know, aren't really auditing or really verifying that to a higher degree. So, you know, SOC 2, you know, it's been around for a long time, but it's really become a lot more popular over the last few years. And essentially, what happens is an IT auditor kind of comes in and verifies, you know, are you actually doing the things to meet these security controls that your company has? And this gives, you know, the you know, your customers, your partners, you know, more confidence that your business is set up, you know, securely and, you know, is something that they feel comfortable using. And I want to be careful there. Like, you know, SOC 2 doesn't mean security. I think sometimes people equate the two. I think it is a good start to setting up your security program. You know, a lot of these frameworks like NIST, you know, ISO 27001, you know, are great as well, but it's not like the end all be all of security.
So maybe a way to think about it is these are more like frameworks, like your SOC 2 compliance is like you're complying with best practices of being secure, but it's not actually the security process.
And yeah, oftentimes, like the first time, you know, a company really starts thinking about their security program is, you know, when they have that first customer that's putting them through this procurement or security process. And that's where, you know, a vendor might ask them, hey, do you have a SOC 2? Do you have an ISO 27001 certification? You know, do you have something that you can use to like kind of prove your security to us so that we, you know, have confidence in using you as a vendor and that we won't have any, you know, security concerns. So, you know, that starts to become like the basis of, you know, a company's security program, but it's definitely not the end. And you definitely want to build upon it, you know, over time, but it's definitely like a great start for a lot of companies.
It's kind of like saving them time. Like if I want to work with a customer, if they were not compliant, like if there's no kind of frameworks or certifications, I could basically say, okay, I'm going to spend months auditing all your stuff and make sure you're secure. Or you can just give me the SOC 2 and say, we've already done this.
Exactly. I mean, oftentimes, like, you know, you might have to do more than, you know, just what, you know, a SOC 2 entails. Like they might want a pen test and, you know, other things. But I think that's a, you know, good, you know, simple way of putting it.
And then talking about some of these other certifications, I think you started, SecureFrame started with SOC 2, and then you've kind of expanded over time to, I don't know how many at this point, but there's quite a bit that you guys cover.
So SecureFrame, we started off with SOC 2 and ISO 27001 because our first two or three customers, you know, needed to get both the SOC 2 report and the ISO 27001 certification. So we, you know, started with that, and very quickly, you know, we had a bunch of customers that were requesting that, you know, we had HIPAA and PCI, and we had a roadmap to kind of, you know, add in, you know, all these frameworks. But when you compare us, you know, to, you know, more traditional solutions, you know, people weren't really thinking about this on a framework by framework basis. They were saying, hey, we have a set of controls or security controls that, you know, we comply with internally. You know, they, you know, map to certain frameworks. So, you know, eventually we, you know, launched what we call custom frameworks so that we could support any framework out of the box, you know, within SecureFrame. So, you know, we have, you know, about 30, you know, templated frameworks within SecureFrame. We're always adding new ones every month, but you could very quickly, you know, add any new framework out there. If I wanted to add the Shrav framework, something I made up yesterday, I could, you know, very quickly, you know, add that into SecureFrame.
So that's something a customer would add, or something that SecureFrame's team adds?
Yeah, so that's something that a customer would add.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So I actually didn't know this. I guess full disclosure, I am an investor in SecureFrame. I didn't know you had these custom. So I can basically say I need to be compliant with these things. Do you guys have like a template builder and then like the AWS connection, all these different tools that we're verifying, you'll automatically piece in those connections into the template that I'm custom building to show I'm compliant to whoever needs the certification or the...
Exactly. So you can basically, you know, upload any controls that you have, any framework that you might want to comply with. Oftentimes, you know, enterprises will have frameworks that, you know, are variations of like SOC 2 or NIST that they're complying with, and they want to, you know, upload or import, you know, their own, you know, variation of that. So we make it super easy to do that within SecureFrame, and then it'll map to, you know, all these automations that we have. So if they have a control within, you know, that custom framework that they upload that says, hey, you need to make sure, you know, everything is encrypted at rest in transit, and, you know, we might be testing, hey, are all your S3 buckets in AWS, you know, encrypted at, you know, rest, you know, do you have public access blocked, things like that.
And these are all things that are, you know, normally best practices, just people may not even know about them. Like they might not even think about blocking public access until a vendor's like, hey, make sure you do this. And then it's like part of the framework.
Yeah, exactly. Or worse, you know, there's a security breach or an incident that they have and they wish they had some of these things in place before.
So how big is the broader compliance market? Is it part of the security market? Like, how do you think about if you're doing like a TAM analysis or like you're analyzing the market, like how big is it and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many numbers out there. I think, you know, the number I've seen, you know, most commonly is that, you know, compliance is an $80 billion, you know, plus market. And, you know, there's different types of compliance, right? It's a very, you know, massive space. There's privacy compliance, there's data compliance, you know, things like, you know, GDPR and CCPA, or there's companies like Big ID, you know, out there that do things that are very different from, you know, what we're doing. So it's a very large space. And you can argue, you know, is that privacy? Is that compliance? Is that both? For, you know, SecureFrame, I think we, you know, fit within the realms of, you know, both security and compliance. We also have some stuff around privacy since we do support, you know, CCPA, CCPRA, GDPR, and, you know, some of the, you know, new privacy frameworks that have been coming out. But it's a very large space, and it, you know, continues to grow every year. You know, there's all sorts of like new laws, new regulations coming out, and I don't think that's, you know, going away.
Yeah, the government loves to make new laws and regulations.
Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes, you know, people view this as like, okay, this is like the tax that you have to pay to, you know, build software. And, you know, we could debate that point, but these things are still very important. You know, if there weren't laws or, you know, standards that companies were requiring people to attest to, I think the state of security for, you know, a lot of software companies or software in general would be, you know, a lot worse. And our goal here at SecureFrame is, you know, not to add to the headache, but really, you know, solve the problem here. We want to make it easy to, you know, comply with all these frameworks and new laws and things that are coming out with automation.
Yeah, I remember when we first met, that was a big point that you made to me, and I was kind of confused, like a little bit. I was kind of like, why is it not automated? Like, this just seems ridiculous that people have to do all this stuff manually. I think I remember it was like 2019 was when you started the company. What was it like 2018, 2019? What was the landscape like?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is kind of funny, but that wasn't the first time I tried to start SecureFrame. There were kind of questions to, you know, whether, you know, a lot of this stuff could be automated, right? So SecureFrame, we integrate with, you know, over 200, you know, different business systems, you know, things like your HR system, your cloud services like Azure, AWS, Google Cloud. We integrate with your version control systems like GitHub or GitLab. And a lot of these services didn't actually have like APIs that we can use to pull down this evidence that you're compliant or help you continuously monitor. Or, you know, AWS maybe had, you know, a bunch of these APIs, but it wasn't developed enough where, you know, it had all the checks and things that we needed. Gusto, Rippling, a lot of these services didn't actually have APIs, you know, at all at that time. So it was, you know, much more difficult to build, you know, something like SecureFrame. And I think, you know, the why now of that moment was really, okay, the APIs, the things that we can use to start automating this, you know, are now available and they're getting better and better. And this is a, you know, a market that's growing. It's a very painful problem. People are spending months on something that, you know, is very clearly automatable, at least in my, you know, eyes at that time.
Yeah, it's an interesting talking about timing too. If it typically, you know, the playbook for a software startup is sell to other startups. You don't necessarily need to be that compliant. They're it's not the highest on the priority list, I guess we'll say. But I feel like as you kind of evolved up along a time where a lot of startups were like, okay, we need to start selling to larger customers. Now we have to start thinking about this. So it was almost like software was proliferating, getting more complicated, but also you needed to be compliant also. So you had like multiple things going for you at the same time. That's what I always thought was interesting.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, you know, pre-SecureFrame, you know, getting a SOC 2 is something that you kind of did at, you know, a later stage. You know, oftentimes, you know, you would be paying like $50,000, you know, just for the certification, not even talking about all the internal work and, you know, things that you'd have to do to actually get compliant. And the problem with that is like most companies like don't have that kind of resourcing early on. So you wait till you're, you know, bigger, more mature, till you can handle, you know, those types of customers. And then you go through that process. But nowadays, it's not just like a large enterprise or something that requires it. It's, you know, other SMB companies, other mid-market companies that are requiring you to get compliant with these certifications. Because oftentimes it's like, hey, if you have a SOC 2 or ISO 27001, you need to, you know, make sure that all your vendors that have sensitive data or information are also compliant. So it's just kind of cascaded and required more and more people to think about their security early on.
Yeah, and didn't you have to do a lot of things manually? Like you had to work with third party kind of auditors, like the accountant version or the lawyer version of compliance stuff. And then it took months, right?
So in the past, this was, you know, very complicated. You'd spend like 6 to 7 months in spreadsheets doing all this work manually. There wasn't like a lot of guidance. Oftentimes, you would just be, you know, putting everything in like a Dropbox folder and then handing it over to your auditor. And then your auditor would give you a bunch of comments back and forth for a couple months. And you're oftentimes just taking screenshots. You're sampling, you know, what's in your AWS account. But when you're using something like SecureFrame, we can quickly, you know, scan your entire AWS account for all instances where, you know, you're not compliant or where you need to fix things, rather than, you know, sampling around and taking a screenshot where you can easily, you know, miss something during an audit.
It sounds like audits have become faster, easier, less friction, and maybe more affordable. Roughly, is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, with all the automation that, you know, we're able to utilize to complete, you know, some of these compliance certifications and continuously monitor them, it's definitely become a lot more affordable. And that's why you're seeing companies, you know, starting to do this earlier on in their life cycles.
Yeah, I know we kind of hit on it earlier, the initial thesis, how you got into it, how it all started. I actually wanted to real quick go even further back, pre-SecureFrame. I think one of the first things you did when we first met, you told me, oh yeah, I used to make Android apps. And like, you casually mentioned you had like multiple games that were top rated. Talk about that. I'm super curious. I think that's a kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I got into programming when I was really young, and it was actually like pretty difficult to learn programming at the time, because you would basically go to Barnes and Nobles, you'd, you know, grab a really thick book that's, you know, meant for like a, you know, college student. And I'm here reading this when I was like 10 years old, trying to just comprehend it, reread it multiple times, you know, try to actually implement the code examples.
So you were like reading, learning how to code, and that's how you learned, was reading the books.
Yeah, you had to read the books. And there was no YouTube videos or things that explained this well. And it wasn't, you know, as entertaining, because, you know, you'd be looking at like, you know, a terminal and writing like a Python program that's like 5 + 8 = 13. Amazing. So much fun. And I think, you know, the thing that, you know, made it just so much more interesting to me actually was when, you know, the iPhone and Android came out. I'm like, oh, wow, I can actually program something, you know, for all these, you know, devices, and I can see it visually. I could show it to my friends. This is way cooler than running some, you know, command line, you know, program. So, you know, that, you know, caused me to dive in very deep into, you know, Android. Actually, the reason I didn't, you know, program for the iPhone at the time was like, it was very difficult to actually get approved as an Apple developer. So I remember I like applied, and they just immediately rejected me because I was like 18. I think they've changed these terms over time, but it was a pain. And it's like there was no support to kind of go back and forth and negotiate with them. And it at the time, it cost $100 a year to get into that program. So I was like, oh my God, huge barrier, you know, all my savings. So I ended up starting on Android because I think it was basically free to get started initially, because they were trying to attract a lot of developers to the platform. And then they had like a nominal like $25 fee. You know, I think it may have even been lifetime. I can't remember. It's been so long. So that was kind of, you know, that made it very easy for me to just do Android. And, you know, Objective-C, you know, was just not a very popular language at the time either, right? I actually didn't have a lot of experience in it, but I did have a lot of experience with, you know, Java. And, you know, that made it just easier to get started on Android. The other nice thing about Android at the time was that the ecosystem was very new. You know, any app I published would instantly get like 50,000 downloads. And I did not realize kind of like the edge I had at that time by being an early Android developer. I just thought I release an app and immediately I get, you know, tons and tons of, you know, visitors. So, you know, any app I published, you know, for maybe the first year, it was not very difficult to get into the top 50, top 100 apps.
Were you marketing them much, or did they just get downloads from just being on the App Store?
Yeah, so a lot of this stuff just got downloads from being on the App Store, because there were like 50 applications. Like the number one like game or app at the time was like Pac-Man, if I remember correctly. So it was not a very like, you know, robust App Store. It was not super well built out. You know, the games that iPhone had were not on Android yet. So it was definitely like a very early, you know, ecosystem. The other problem, you know, back in the day is Android didn't even actually have a paid app store yet. So there was not a super easy way to monetize. Like, think about the fact that like mobile ad networks hadn't really even come out. You know, there was a bunch that were coming out. The one that I used at the time, if I remember correctly, was AdMob. And then you'd use this thing called AdWhirl, which would rotate between a bunch of mobile ad networks, and you'd implement that SDK, and it would rotate between whatever makes you the most money. And these were not super sophisticated, you know, ad SDKs at the time, and they were always constantly being updated, but they didn't have proper like click spam protections and things like that. So, you know, every time I had like a button on my app, I would, you know, put the ads like right above the button, and people would like accidentally click that, and people would ask me, what's my secret? And I would be like, oh, that's the secret. I just put the ads like super close to the button. And they're like, well, and someone was, you know, talking to me at the time, well, don't you want to have a great user experience? You should make those like buttons bigger and easier to click. And I'm like, no, ad revenue will go down if we make the buttons easier to click. Like, I didn't think about the user experience or anything like that. I didn't understand, you know, the edge I had maybe wasn't going to last forever. I can't, you know, there's going to be other developers that figure this out and want to publish their apps, you know, very quickly. And if they can immediately get, you know, 50,000 downloads from just publishing, of course, a bunch more people are going to do it. But at the time I had, you know, an Android account that, you know, it would immediately start getting things ranked or in the new or featured section because I already had, you know, a bunch of popular apps. But again, actually, one of the big problems is like you could never really have paid apps on Android because once they actually launched it, there were all these like very simple ways that people could just request a refund like within 24 hours and still keep the app. There were just some, you know, just ridiculous loopholes that would get used like almost all the time. And over time that got fixed. But, you know, I launched a paid version of some of my apps and I made like $100. So I was like, okay, this isn't feasible. But the ads, you know, I could make like $4,000 or $5,000 a month, you know, from like the ad mob and the networks that were on AdWhirl.
This was per game?
Yeah, like per app, per game. I believe I only launched one game, and we spent, you know, 2 years actually like building this game. It was very complicated stuff. You know, I was working on it with one or two other friends I had kind of recruited, and you know, there weren't really great graphics libraries on Android. They weren't very powerful, so we were like writing OpenGL code, and I remember we were posting on like Stack Overflow, and people are not nice on Stack Overflow. And so like, I remember I would start posts with like, really need help with this thing. And people would be like, you noobs, you guys don't belong here. And then I would like delete the post. I'm like, I regret this. We'll just bang our head against the computer for 8 hours and figure this out. And that would usually work. But it was like a very tough, you know, ecosystem. But you know, all that finagling, all that, you know, figuring out, you know, how to build apps, how to monetize and, you know, market it was, you know, very, you know, it was a big learning experience that, you know, still, you know, some of the lessons from that time I use today.
Yeah. And then I think you got your first kind of real job, or I don't know if we want to call it that. You were super young, right? Were you 17 or 18, if I'm remembering?
I think I was like 16, and you know, it was like, you know, basically contracting, you know, for a bunch of startups. Basically, anyone who would let me program, because to me, programming was like super, super fun, and I would do it for free all day. I just wanted to like work on something, you know, amazing and have like a, you know, be like a real adult at the time, I guess is what was going on in my head. You know, I ended up, you know, meeting Lior, who's the CEO of this company called Lob. And they came out of YC, and I was a huge fan of YC at the time. I had read all of Paul Graham's essays, and I knew, you know, at some point I wanted to, you know, create a company or a startup of my own. And so Lior ended up, you know, offering me, you know, an internship at Lob at the time. And, you know, I had a blast. It really changed kind of the direction of my career.
And Lob, just so we get it on the record, is direct mail automation. Like direct mail, those little things you get in the mail from like the mattress company or the bank, new checking account, those kind of things. It was basically like some kind of automation tool for that, correct?
Exactly. So Lob makes it super easy to send, you know, direct mail, things like postcards, letters, checks automatically, you know, via an API. And behind the scenes, you know, there's like a print delivery network that, you know, is properly QA'd so that, you know, any mail piece that you have is sent from a facility near where it's going so you can send mail faster. And this is kind of an industry that, you know, needed to be brought into the future and, you know, brought into a way where direct mail could be more personalized, more automated. And Lob, you know, became the system to do that.
Yeah, it's a pretty big market too. 40, 50 billion, just sending people ads in the mail, basically. Fascinating. And then I think you were there for a year or two. And then you worked at a company called Hired. I'm not super familiar with them. What did they do again?
Hired made it easy to hire software developers. And, you know, as you know, hiring engineers is really, really tough. And the cool thing kind of about Hired at the time was that people would, you know, make you kind of, you know, an offer with like a compensation amount, you know, before you kind of even interviewed at the company, like just based on, you know, your resume references that you can get added into Hire that were verified, companies that you had worked at, and you'd kind of go through this approval process, and then you'd be kind of launched on the platform, you know, for, you know, like a week or 2 weeks. And essentially, you know, companies could kind of take a look at your resume and say, hey, you know, we, you know, if we decide to make an offer and move forward, here's how much, you know, we would, you know, initially pay you. And people would still negotiate and change this over time. But the problem that a lot of engineers, you know, were facing is like, you know, they'd go through a whole interview process and then the compensation that they were offered was less than they were making now by a substantial amount. But they spent, you know, weeks interviewing, taking sick days from their current company, you know, before remote work existed, I guess. And if you're interviewing at five or six places, it can be, you know, kind of difficult to manage all that. So, you know, the idea was more to like set expectations, you know, up front. And that was like really compelling to a lot of engineers. And you would essentially have companies apply to you instead of the other way around. You know, we hired on our end, we would make sure that the companies followed up with you appropriately, that, you know, you weren't ghosted, because there were just so many inefficiencies in these hiring processes. So we wanted to deliver a great candidate experience, but also a great company experience. Ultimately, like, you know, recruiting is a very, very difficult business to make work. It's just very inherently personal. But, you know, the founders of Hired were great. You know, they had started, you know, Flippa, you know, a bunch of other companies like LiveOps, you know, beforehand. And I really wanted to work, you know, with incredible founders and people that I could really learn from.
And then I think you went back to Lob. I think initially it was maybe you were helping at Lob, Hired, and then you spent 2 years at Lob. And then you worked at Scale for a couple of years, Scale AI. This was like 2017. That was pretty early for Scale, right?
Yeah. So I ended up, you know, going back to Lob. Like, you know, I had like dinner with Lior probably like every month, and I'd tell him this is like what I'm working on, super excited. And he's like, Shrav, you should just come back to Lob and work here, and you can do this project here that would also be really exciting. But I think it's like we had developed a really, you know, good relationship at that point. And so I decided to, you know, kind of go to Lob. And, you know, I made a lot of really great, you know, friends at Hired too, people I, you know, still, you know, speak with, you know, to this day. You know, one of my, you know, close friends is this person, Lenny, who's the CEO of Crusted Health. And there's been a lot of companies that have come from Hired as well. So yeah, after, you know, after Lob, I ended up working at Scale. And, you know, Scale was actually, I think we called it Scale API at that point. And, you know, I had known, you know, Alexander and Lucy. They had lived in this kind of hacker house with a bunch of other Teal fellows. And I had some friends that I would kind of often visit there. I had been, you know, talking with, you know, Alex and Lucy a little bit about APIs and things that they can use to kind of grow Scale, and, you know, tactics that had worked. And, you know, over time, I decided, okay, I was ready for a new challenge. And I think Alexander and Lucy are some of the, you know, smartest people that I know, and they worked really hard. So I was like, okay, I really want to join this team. So I joined as one of the first few employees after Lob.
And then one of the really interesting aspects, I think, of your career kind of segues into Pilot. We've had Wasim on the show in the past. I think you were a pilot for a year or two. I'm just looking at your LinkedIn. Almost 2 years, I guess. One of Wasim's big questions for you that he said I needed to ask you, you decided to really focus on marketing. I mean, you kind of always done mostly engineering, but it seems like this, and you'd kind of done a little bit of marketing, but it seems like Pilot, it was, I'm really focused on the marketing side. How did that transition to Pilot come about, and why did you decide marketing was so important?
Yeah. So at all these companies I've been at, I'd kind of done, you know, a bit of both, right? I applied kind of systems thinking, or, you know, the skills I had learned in engineering, not just to product anymore, but actually to marketing and growth. And every company I was at, growth was, you know, always the challenge, right? You're always trying to figure out how to grow more revenue. And, you know, very quickly, you know, I started to try to take on those challenges. And I'm like, oh, actually, this is like really fun. I think I'm actually, you know, decent at it. And, you know, we were able to kind of grow some of the companies I was at very quickly with some of these tactics I had, you know, put in place. And when I had gone to, you know, pilot, you know, I think they told me like, actually, we really just need someone full time focused on marketing. Like, you know, if you want to use some of these engineering skills and stuff, you know, that's interesting and, you know, useful as well. So, you know, at that point, I kind of made, you know, the full shift over to marketing. And I had a lot of experience with it. I just didn't really maybe articulate that over time. But, you know, when I was building Android apps, you know, I had to do a lot of my own marketing, and I had a $0, you know, budget that I worked with. So I'd post on every form. I would spam like hundreds and thousands of emails like that I would find on Crunchbase, and I would scrape. Like I would literally
download my app, like download my game.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So I built a scraper to scrape as many emails as possible. And then I would use some like free AWS credits or, you know, email, you know, services I found online. And then I would mass send a bunch of emails. And then I remember, I think these folks would, you know, email me saying, are you sending spam email at the time? And I'm like, well, some people might think it's spam, but I don't think it is. And it's, you know, generating a lot of awareness, and no one responded to that email. they were fine. Like today, you know, if I was doing that stuff, you know, in 5 minutes, HubSpot would be emailing us to shut down our account, right? But you could get away with a lot more, you know, back in the day. So I learned a lot about, you know, cold emailing, how to write really compelling emails, marketing messaging, you know, how to, you know, work with a very small budget and still generate like a lot of awareness. And I was able to apply these skills I learned from like Lob and Hired and, you know, these other companies, and really, you know, use them to grow, you know, other startups and, you know, SecureFrame itself too. So at Pilot, you know, we did a lot around, you know, digital marketing. You know, I think Wasim and I were oftentimes still the ones that were updating the marketing website and coming up with the graphics and, you know, figuring out new campaigns and things to run. And I think marketing is getting way more technical. You can get a lot out of applying systems thinking to marketing these days.
Yeah, it's an interesting parallel to what Wade Foster, a founder of Zapier, he was on the show maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago. One of his big takeaways, or my big takeaway from that convo, was the process of product market fit. Like, it's not just this, we made the product and then we figured out how to market it. It was the marketing and the product is kind of one thing. So you build, like you engineer the product, you design the product with the marketing in mind. And that just kind of leads to structurally lower CAC, faster customer acquisition, just like a better business, better margins overall, just because you have the marketing so ingrained with how you actually built the product in the first place. So I wonder if you maybe had some of those skills from doing all the building to then also the marketing too, is all kind of pieced together.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. Like, you know, when you think about building a product, I think it's important to think about growth and, you know, how does this get into the hand of users? You know, is the onboarding experience, you know, simple? Are people churning away from your app, right? If everyone's churning, you know, it's very difficult. And what I would say is not all business models are suitable for that type of marketing, right? Like in Uber, I guess it's more B2C, but, you know, same thing. Like they focus very heavily on that referrals page, that referral screen, and, you know, getting that, you know, rider their first ride is, you know, very, you know, key metric for those types of companies. For, you know, a company that like Lob, you know, it's an API company. So we focus a lot on content marketing, a lot of the same stuff that companies like Twilio that, you know, pioneered, you know, that API space. It is something that you can sign up for right away. So we tracked things like, hey, how long did it take to get someone to their first API request, right? What issues were they running into? Can we, you know, create some quick scripts or, you know, libraries or things that will make it easier to integrate something like Lob, right? And then there's some companies that, you know, are, you just have to straight sell an enterprise software subscription, right? There's, if you're selling something like ServiceNow, for example, you're not really going to be able to growth hack your way into that. You know, you're selling to companies over 2,000 employees, you're signing multi-year contracts, you know, you're talking about like $10, $20 million to implement the thing probably, and a whole team of people to do that, right? You're not going to PLG or growth hack your way into some of those products. It really depends. But if you can, you know, and your product is more suitable for those kind of things, then yes, you know, you definitely want to be thinking about that, those kind of tactics.
So I actually have two more quick questions from Wasim at Pilot. He mentioned you have a discount Aeron supplier. What does that even mean?
when he's talking about the Herman Miller Aeron chairs. So, you know, I like every company I was at, like we would just buy these used, and there's like warehouses full of them, like around SF and Oakland, that, you know, hey, when startups like shut down and stuff, they, you know, liquidate everything. And there's tons of these. So I thought, you know, most companies, you know, just bought Aerons from there, but we were, you know, buying them on, you know, Amazon full price. And I was like, wait, we're buying these like full price. We're about to buy like 20 or 30 of them. Why don't we just get these from a warehouse? They're basically, you know, brand new. And we saved, you know, like a ton of money, you know, doing that. And I think like over time, people were like, hey, like, you know, if these only cost like $200 to $300 when we're buying them in bulk, like, you know, can you snag me one? I want one for my home office. And we had a bunch of people where we had like a separate order for people who wanted them for their home office. I mean, they were a hit, you know, when COVID hit.
Yeah, it's always good to be the guy that has the plug on discounted office chairs.
Yeah, I'm a super thrifty person, and you know, I care about UK. You know, if we're buying, you know, something, like buy it for life or buy something that's good quality. And these things are assets; you can sell them, you know, later. So, you know, when I see these kind of things, I'm like, okay, if we can get the same quality, you know, for less, you know, why not?
Yeah, save a couple $1,000s, tens of thousands, possibly hundreds, depending on the scale. Yeah. Well, Seem actually had one other thing. He said you were, so you kind of didn't go to college, but I think you also kind of did college sort of on the side while you were working full time. And he said there's a story of you trying to finish your college finals while working at Pilot.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, you know, I wasn't like officially a college dropout. I was kind of always doing like one class on the side. But, you know, at some point I said, hey, I just want to get this college degree thing, you know, over with so I can be fully focused on, you know, whatever else I, you know, want to do. And so, you know, when I first started at Pilot, I was actually just working like 3 days a week. And the other 2 days, I would actually be, you know, working on my college courses and like showing up on time. And I basically ended up cramming like 3 years of college in one. And, you know, people thought it was like absolutely crazy. And you're only doing it for, you know, 2 days a week. But I think, you know, having worked at, you know, some of these startups, you know, my work ethic had developed to, you know, another level where I felt like, okay, this wasn't actually that difficult. Like, think about it. In college or like in high school, you're in classes, you know, all day from basically, if I remember, it was like 7 a.m. or 6 a.m. if you had like zero period, all the way to like 3 p.m. And then you would basically do homework or sports right afterwards for like 2-3 hours and then homework for like the rest of the night. And then you'd rinse and repeat that for 5 days a week. And then when you go to college, there's this like weird thing where, you know, you don't attend the lectures that you have for like a couple hours a week. And this was like perplexing to me. I'm like, okay, these lectures are only for like on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Tuesday and Thursday. And they take like an hour, you know, each time. And, you know, half the students don't even attend them unless there's an exam or a quiz. And oftentimes they're recorded and, you know, put online. So I'm like, how did we go from this like crammed, you know, grind of like a, you know, now what I consider high school is like a 15, 16 hour like work day, or maybe not, maybe it's like more like 12 hours, like a 12 hour day, and go to this thing where we're doing like just a couple courses at once. So I'm like, I think I can do like 9 of these courses at once on a quarter system. And I had, you know, a decent amount of like programming knowledge and stuff before. So I don't think like the actual material or the content was like particularly hard. It was just the fact that, okay, I had to do all these like problem sets and like just writing a lot of, you know, homework assignments and things out that actually ended up taking a lot of time. So you had to be very good about time management. I think, you know, the joke that sometimes, like, you know, with Steve and Jeff, Pilot CEO, would make is like, man, we get Shrav is working at Pilot for 3 days a week, but he's working the weekend, he's doing all these other things. So we're getting like a really great deal here. But I was just happy to be working with like really great founders like them, to be honest. And I was having a blast working there. Great people, probably one of my, you know, favorite companies to have worked at. And, you know, I would basically, you know, go to work, you know, on, you know, Monday. And then on Tuesday, I would wake up at, you know, basically like 5 or 6 a.m., drive for like 2 hours to Santa Cruz. And then I would basically you know, I had my first like lecture at like 8 a.m. and it was like a teacher that required you to go to them. So those were like the ones I really just, you know, had to actually go to. And then, you know, my last lecture would end up like at 8 p.m. I'd try to finish homework, get some, you know, work from Pilot in, you know, during the day. And then I would, you know, get home by like 11 p.m. and then, you know, do the same thing. You know, on Wednesday, go to Pilot. Thursday, I would go to school. Friday, I'd go to Pilot. And then the weekend, I would be cramming in, you know, all these homework assignments, you know, things I needed to get done, chores. And it was like a very jam-packed schedule. And it was probably like one of the hardest years of my life in just terms of like the workload that I was taking on. But I, you know, I knew I could, you know, get through it. And I was very motivated to, you know, graduate and just put this behind me.
Okay, so you got through that insane slug of college. Yeah. And then you started SecureFrame. This was about four-ish years ago, a little over 4 years ago. How did you initially kind of come up with the idea? Were you super familiar with compliance? Because I know we talked quite a bit about the market. What made you, what was that moment when you're like, all right, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah. So there was like, you know, a bunch of different ideas that I was interested in. So, you know, most of the ideas revolved primarily around security, some around, you know, AI. And, you know, I, you know, always kind of keep a list of, you know, things I'm thinking about or problems I'm having, like maybe there's a business that can come about it. And I was kind of more entrepreneurial in that, you know, nature. And I would always kind of ask people like, hey, if I built a product, you know, around this, like, you know, would you buy it? And I was working on like, you know, 2 to 3 different things at the time. You know, recruiting is just really not best space is the way I would put it. It's inherently, you know, very personal. It's very difficult to scale. And, you know, VCs also really don't love recruiting businesses. Not to say that's like the primary reason you shouldn't start a business. You know, if you start a great business and ultimately works, like the VCs will come. And that's also not the only way to start a business. But, you know, I settled on SecureFrame because, you know, it was one of the, you know, ideas in security that we were interested in. And I had talked to some customers and, you know, all of a sudden, like, you know, people were sending me intros and referrals saying, hey, Shroff can help you with some of this SOC 2 stuff or show you how to use these templates. So I started, you know, talking to some of these folks on, you know, the phone, and I would say, hey, you know, if I, you know, built a product to automate this, you know, would you use it? And a bunch of people were kind of like, yeah, I would use this. And this seems like they're just being nice to me or, you know, because they're my friend and I don't want to be, you know, misled. And then one of them calls me up a month later and they're like, okay, Shroff, we're waiting. You know, where is it? You know, we're ready to use the, you know, software you were talking about. And I was like, oh, I actually didn't, you know, build it. I didn't know that you really, really, you know, wanted it. So, you know, I immediately, you know, kind of quit my job at Pilot and we, you know, got to the races. We built, you know, the first MVP in like a couple weeks to get started and, you know, helped with some of these people with some scripts manually while, you know, the product was getting built. And, you know, by the time we had kind of like the full MVP ready, we had maybe 30 to 40 people in line who hadn't really even, you know, seen the product, who were just ready to use it. And I was like, you know, that was kind of the moment for me where I'm like, okay, I think we actually, you know, have something here. I see, you know, a viable, you know, product that we can sell for a decent amount of money that clearly a lot of people want. And one of my sayings is kind of, if you're in a really, really, really big market, you should be able to find at least one person that's willing to buy the product before you have it even built, before you've written even a line of code. Oftentimes I see so many startups that write a ton of code, have a really well-built, fully featured product that no one wants to use, or that they didn't properly validate, or they're saying things to themselves like, if I just built this one feature, someone will come and use it. And the reality is like, look, if you're building in a very large market, someone will come to you before you build that feature and like maybe give you the money to validate it or, you know, build that for you. So that's something I always kind of encourage people to do is, you know, really validate, you know, their ideas before, you know, writing, you know, any line of code. So it was very clear with all the people that we had in line. And I think the vision was very clear for where we would expand. We would initially, you know, support all the controls and all the frameworks and things that, you know, companies need. We would, you know, launch more and more integrations, you know, to automate things. And we could very quickly expand into like what SecureFrame Trust is today, which is like our questionnaire automation and a whole bunch of other, you know, security and compliance products that we have, you know, coming out over time. So all the things just started to click, you know, very quickly. And ended up just having like casual lunches with people and folks were like, well, when you're ready to, you know, start the company, we're ready to, you know, write a check. And I was like, you don't want to, see this deck or this and that. And, they're like, hey, we, did a bunch of reference calls. We talked to some of the people that are waiting in line for this. And, we really like this. So yeah, when you're ready, we're down. And, just to formalize it, I did actually make a deck and put together all these materials because I wanted to take it super seriously. And, the fundraise, we got a lot of like no's, but eventually once we got a couple yeses, it started to, you started to, build more confidence, and we figured out how to put together the seed round. And, from there we, got a lot better at, fundraising and figuring those things out. But the reason I share this is like, I think it's, again, VC is not the only way to start a business. I think it was probably the right call, for SecureFrame, but it is, not the only way to start one.
Yeah, because I think it did help you just go a little bit faster, gave you money on the balance sheet, hire more people, build the product faster. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, when I told like VC is my plan and saying like, I'm not really raising right now. I'm actually just going to put in my own money. And, once we get to $1 million in revenue, we're going to go raise a Series A and, stuff like that. And I think for some VCs, that was actually like more compelling to them. Like, wow, this guy is just putting his savings, like he really believes in this. So that I think was kind of like a, funny thing as well.
What do you think is a good framework then to think about fundraising? It's don't actually need money. Like, is that a good takeaway? Is like build it without raising anything, and then that's kind of how you get investors on board. Like, is that a fair summary? Or
What I would say ultimately is like, I have a lot of conversations with founders, and like, the number one topic oftentimes is like, well, tell me about fundraising, what fundraising advice you have. And it's oftentimes not about like, hey, how do you build a great product? How do you find product market fit? It's like, how do you fundraise? And ultimately, I think the answer is like, you have to build like a really great business. If you build a really great business, the VCs will come to you. It is going to be much easier to do a pitch. I've seen, some, I won't name any names or anything, but I've seen some like great businesses with, great founders who maybe, aren't like the best, how would I put it? They're not the best at maybe pitching their company or fundraising. And, VCs will still hand them giant checks because they have a freaking amazing product. And that's ultimately, what matters.
And then when you think about having a good business, good product, bad at fundraising, that might be trickier early on when the numbers aren't there. But later on, good at fundraising, but no business, no product, like you're kind of, it's a dead end. Like you can't keep going. So you really need to have a good business, a good product. It might be a grind, but eventually you get to a point where the numbers speak for themselves. The product and the business speaks for itself. And it's maybe not the most exciting thing to hear if you're just starting the company, but I mean, it's kind of true.
It's 100% true. You really do need to build like a great business these days. And, there's countless startups that have raised a lot of money and, haven't really built a great business. And, many of these will hopefully, get there. But ultimately, if you're trying to like raise a good round, build a great business. The other thing I'll kind of say is, not everyone, has the savings or has the ability to necessarily like build a company without some venture funding or without the ability to, pay a salary. And, that's tough. Like, I'm not going to say that this situation, works for everyone, but, building a startup was something I planned on doing for a long time. So I'd kind of prepared, to pay myself, very little or nothing for a long time. I had kind of, gotten everything in order so I could, be 100%, dedicated to working on SecureFrame. And so, if you have the, ability to, planning, ahead of time, before you start your company, it can make a, big difference.
You've raised a little bit more since then. How should somebody approach raising like a Series A, kind of the first maybe big institutional round? How did that come about for you? Just general process. And then what are some things for other founders to think about?
A lot of people who have, fundraised more recently, like they're thinking about the 2021, early 2022 times. And fundraising was very different during those times. I don't think we're going to see a repeat of that, for, a long while or, potentially ever. When it comes to, fundraising for your Series A, I know people hate this, but there's kind of that like 1 million ARR, golden, benchmark. And
yeah, I feel like it's like 2 or 3 now, honestly. I think I actually saw the average Series A done in 2023 had grown 6x year over year. And it was something like 2 million in rep in ARR, roughly. That might be wrong, but I remember the growth. You were, the average Series A that was closed was growing 6x year over year.
I mean, anecdotally, from some deals I've seen recently, I think you might be right. But you've heard of that 1 million golden ARR rule and like the controversy behind it to go, oh, this company got funded at $0 in ARR and this one, you know, didn't get funded at 5 million in ARR. But like, you have to take the context of all those things. So, you know, I was talking with a founder the other day and he's like, well, you know, my friend's company raised at 200K. And so like, you know, we should be able to raise another round, you know, at this point too, right? And I was like, well, you know, I can say yes if that's what you want to hear from me, and you very well might, you know, be able to. Like, I don't want to say it's impossible, because you know, we see that happen, you know, all the time. But there's so much context that goes into it, right? What's your growth rate? You know, if you're about to hit a million in ARR, you know, within 2 months, and it's very clear from the growth that you have, like, hey, you closed 200K this month, 500K this month. Well, next month, if you're closing like 700 or 800K, well, you're going to hit that benchmark. And, you know, some VC might want to get in there early, you know, before everyone else finds out that you're going to, that you're growing like weed and are going to be ready to raise a Series A soon, right? And sometimes there's just certain theses that like VC firms have, and that convinces them to, you know, go in earlier on a company than they might normally, right? There's all sorts of reasons why someone, you know, might do that. Sometimes second time and third time founders, they just have better relationships with VCs. They've done this before and they're stronger fundraisers, so they're able to create a more compelling story or reason to invest in them earlier than, you know, other companies might be able to receive funding, right? So there's all sorts of context, like that 5 million ARR company that wasn't able to raise a Series A. What if, you know, 80% of that revenue was services revenue, or the margin was bad, or the churn wasn't great, or it was in a sector where the TAM was very limited and there wasn't really an opportunity to get to 100 million in ARR or a billion in ARR there that, you know, made it less fundable, right? So there's all sorts of things that can kind of go into it. What I'd ultimately say for raising a Series A, or really raising venture in general, is like, people think about the IPO as the big exit, right? You have to, you know, probably hit 200, 300 million in ARR these days to kind of go public. Debate those numbers right now, but you know, you have to have a lot of revenue to get there. So people are like, okay, if I can get this business to 200 or 300 million in ARR and IPO, we're done. But it's really actually the day after the IPO, right? In order to like kind of qualify for an IPO, you essentially need to, you know, be probably growing, you know, 100, 200, 300 million in ARR, 30% year over year growth. And like, you're seeing the bar of companies of, as of this moment in early 2024, the bar is so much higher than that. Maybe when the IPO window opens sometime in the near future, you know, we're going to see that bar lower or change a bit. But, you know, once you actually, you know, are to qualify to go public, back to that point, it's not just hitting that, you know, 300 mil milestone, let's say. It's the fact that you have to have a path to hitting $1 billion in revenue within the next like 5 to 7 years. And, you know, you have to be ready to forecast your earnings with a very high degree of confidence, right? You have to have a public company leadership team. You have to, you know, be ready to, you know, essentially nail your first 2 years of earnings and have a high predictability in your ability to do that. So ultimately, like, when you think about raising venture, if you're thinking about the IPO as your ultimate exit, which is what really you should be aiming for when you raise venture, you're not aiming for a $100 million revenue company or a $50 million revenue company. You're ultimately aiming for a path to $1 billion that you can, you know, buy people in on.
And probably more too. Optionality of saying, here's how we do 5 billion, 10 billion in revenue. Like, we're building a generational company. Like, this is a very long-term, this is a big opportunity. This is, yeah, to your point, it's not like, oh, 100 million and we're done and we never grow. That's just almost like the start. Like, when you look back 50 years later, it's like, oh, they're doing 26 billion in revenue, whatever, we'll say an insane number. You know, you cross that 200 million in revenue to IPO, you're like 1% of the way there, whatever the math comes out to.
Exactly. So like, if you don't have that path to a bill, you're not going to get an IPO. And if that's the ultimate exit you're looking for, like, you ultimately need, you know, a path to get there. Now, look, there is M&A and other you know, paths to, you know, being successful in other terms, you know, in venture. But ultimately, like when you're raising a seed round or a Series A or something, you're thinking about the IPO. Like that's what you really should be thinking about when you raise that kind of money. So that's one piece of it that I don't think people talk about enough. But the second piece of it is, I think you, like, just, you know, going back to like the stage that you're at, like as a small company, you have to kind of have some form of product market fit, or at least like early signs of it. I think that was kind of one of the traditional markers of a Series A. And you want to make you want to have a clear path to like the day after the Series A, right? Again, a lot of people think $1 million in revenue, let's go, let's raise that Series A. But what happens after you raise the money? Like, you know, can you take that money and, you know, hire your first few execs? You know, can you, you know, get that to 5 or 10 million in revenue, or the metrics that, you know, your business is going to be expected to hit to raise a Series B with the money that you raise, right? And then for the Series B, the bar gets higher. You know, can this become, you know, $100 million revenue business? You know, what are the outcomes that my VCs are typically looking for at the growth stage? So it's not just about hitting $1 million in revenue. If you take 5 years to hit $1 million in revenue, well, you know, on the 7 to 10 year IPO timeline for most companies, like, will you ever, you know, hit even $2 million in revenue, right? You have to have that path, you know, afterwards. And if you feel confident in that, and there's clear signals that that's happening, that's, you know, more of what I think about when raising a Series A.
Yeah. And then too, it's not just you raise the money and that's the goal. The goal is like you're building a business, and by raising capital, you can invest it in the business and actually get to your end goal faster and probably capture market share, build a competitive advantage, whether it's like a network effect, economy of scale, building out your brand, IP, whatever your competitive advantage as a business will be at scale. Raising venture is a way to get there faster if you use it correctly. So like talking about what happens after you raise some money, like your first institutional round, you need to hire people. I know you have some philosophies on hiring. We're going to hit on a little bit. How do you approach hiring just generally?
Yeah. So, you know, we try to hire really hardworking people that are very motivated. I want people that are self-motivated, that I don't have to, you know, micromanage or tell them what to do, you know, all the time or anything. Of course, that's what everyone, you know, wants, fairly, you know, basic stuff. But, you know, we look for things like, hey, is this person above maybe their years of experience or where the average person would be, you know, in their career? Are they able to, you know, communicate really well? You know, we do a lot of like very thorough reference checks, and, you know, we're asking, you know, a lot of deep questions to just understand the candidate better. And we hone in on that a lot. I think it's really important to do, you know, thorough reference checks on candidates, especially if they have a lot of experience. Talk to their, you know, direct reports if they were a manager or a leader, you know, talk to the people that manage them, you know, understand what it takes to work really well, you know, with this person. You know, are they the right fit for the stage and size that you're currently at, right? You know, oftentimes like companies will hire execs that, you know, are a better fit for a later stage, aren't going to be able to operate very well at the early stage, right? They might have all these fancy logos on their resume. And ultimately they have those fancy logos because, and they're fancy logos because they're probably large companies that you recognize and stuff. You got to be really careful when you optimize for things like, oh, they have great logos on their resume. You know, think about why those are great logos. You know, there's certain companies that, you know, just were a rocket ship, and you maybe didn't have to, you know, necessarily grind or do as much work, you know, to be successful there, right? But like, you know, you want to hire the person maybe at like the number two company in a space. Like you want to hire the person that had to like will, you know, the company into existence and like force it into working. You know, nothing at startups ever really works. You kind of have to like will it into existence, which is something that, you know, we talk a lot about at SecureFrame. But, you know, have a very thorough hiring process. Spend the time to interview a candidate. You know, we try to meet, you know, every candidate in person these days, you know, as well. I think that was one thing that was kind of taken away during COVID in the remote environment. I remember, you know, we were, you know, building SecureFrame's team out, and it was particularly difficult because I don't know if you even remember those times, but I was like, I don't know if I can interview someone just over Zoom and make a hiring decision for the first few employees. It's like really, really scary to kind of even, you know, think about. And we had no choice. That was the point in COVID, like, you know, March 2020, maybe, where, you know, we were just scared to meet in person. We didn't know what COVID was going to do to you.
Yeah, that's when you did the very first seed round, right? It was like March of 2020, if I'm remembering right.
Exactly. Like we had closed it like right before kind of COVID hit. And, you know, I was thinking in my head, oh, will the wire come? Will the wire come? and luckily the wires did come and, you know, everything, you know, worked out. So there was no issue there. But it was definitely very difficult to hire and kind of make that, you know, mental shift. Ultimately, the first few people I hired are people that I'd worked very closely with before. But, you know, eventually I got more comfortable, you know, hiring people over Zoom and, you know, figuring out other ways that we can kind of get that signal. And now, you know, that's super, super common, right? Oftentimes when we did first interviews back when we were in person, we would do them over phone, like Uber conference or something. We wouldn't even use like a video or Zoom call. But now that's just like expected, you know, for a first interview or first phone call.
So how do you do? You mentioned something super interesting was doing very thorough reference checks. How do you do a reference check for someone who's never done one before?
So there's a bunch of different, you know, questions that I, you know, start off with. But ultimately, I'm trying to really like dig deep into their experience, like what kind of impacts do they have at the company? What are the biggest things that they did to drive change? You know, one piece of advice, you know, I'd gotten is no one's perfect. There's always like a negative thing, you know, about, you know, someone. And, you know, if you have a reference check that is just all, you know, A plus, all good things, I think it's important to like at least kind of get, you know, one negative thing. Otherwise, you haven't done, you know, a thorough reference check or really dug, you know, deep enough, right? I'm not a perfect person. If you dig deep enough on a reference check, like you should be able to get something negative about me. Otherwise, you probably didn't do that reference check, you know, thoroughly enough. I think that kind of stuff is like very important. And oftentimes when you're hiring someone, a lot of people have this natural inclination to note down what they want to hear and kind of ignore red and yellow flags. So we try to be, you know, very thorough about it. Like I don't count a reference check as a reference check unless we got something, you know, negative or an area for improvement. And then I want to dig deeper onto that, you know, topic.
Yeah. So how do you pull that out? Like, let's say you're doing a reference with me and I'm just saying all these great things about someone. Is there a question you can ask to like get me to say something negative?
Yeah. I mean, I try to like feel it out. You know, there's like, you know, clever kind of ish questions that you can ask people. Like if you were to pair, you know, Turner and, you know, with another person, you know, who might that person be? And, you know, the things that they compliment or say, hey, like, you know, you want to pair Turner with someone who's like really organized. And I'm like, okay, so that means they're unorganized, right? I'm giving a very rudimentary, you know, example here. And some people will like catch on to that. But, you know, I oftentimes just try to be like very direct. I don't like try to beat around the bush. I'm like, you know, can you give me, you know, something that they had to improve upon, you know, when they first joined your company, you know, what did they look like? You know, what were some of the issues that maybe they had and how did they improve those issues? How did this candidate or how did this, you know, employee progress over time at your company? You know, there's a lot of things that you can ask them like, okay, you know, did they fix these things, you know, over time? Did they iterate? Did they get way better?
One kind of adjacent question that I thought you had some interesting points on. What is the best way to apply for a job at a startup? You said basically warm intro is the best. Strong cold emails to the founder also works. Applying to jobs on the job application is usually, I think you've said in your experience, just fewer lower quality applications that way. And then you also said that the open to work thing on LinkedIn is like the worst possible thing you could do as a candidate. I know we just did a lot of things there, but could you kind of talk through those? Highest signal way is a warm intro.
Yeah, yeah. So the last one is a bit more of a joke, but I'll get into that. But yeah, look, a warm intro, you know, is always the best. And, you know, I think about, you know, who's the person that made the intro? You know, who are the candidates that they've sent me in the past? And, you know, are they really good? Like this person, you know, sent us like some of our best, you know, performing employees. I respond to that email right away. Let's get on a call tomorrow or tonight. And then, you know, strong cold emails. Like you'd be surprised, but I actually, you know, don't really get a lot of strong cold emails.
And really?
Yeah. It's kind of surprising, actually. Like, you know, especially if you're, you know, looking for a sales role or something, I think, you know, the first thing that you could do to show that you're, you know, a great candidate for the job is shoot over a cold email to me, to our VP of sales, to someone to kind of get that job. It just stands out, right? Like when you see all these applications come through on Lever or Greenhouse or whatever you use, it's like, you know, a giant stack of like, you know, 1,000 or a couple thousand can come in like a single week. And
they probably all look the same too. Like it's probably so hard to even like distinguish people.
Oh yeah, no. They do all kind of like look the same. I mean, you get very good at like looking at the resumes quickly, looking for the right skills. But yeah, you end up just kind of in this giant stack with a bunch of other people. So like the very, you know, if you don't maybe have a warm intro to you know, the hiring manager or whoever might be responsible, you know, that's all right, but you can also just send a very good cold email to the founder or, you know, to, you know, who the hiring manager might be. I still don't get like a ton of these days. So, you know, I could tell you that it's a good way to, you know, stand out.
So how do you send a good cold email? Like if you were to open something from me applying for sales role or trying to sell you something or an investor trying to invest in SecureFrame, what do you want to see you as Shrav at SecureFrame in a cold email?
It's like one of these things where like these is like, when I see it, I know it.
Shorter, usually better versus just a long narrative.
Definitely shorter. Like if you're writing an essay, like it's going to be, you know, tough for me to spend the time to like parse through the whole thing to get to the substance.
I found if you need to send an essay, PDF, like you can reference, here's like a longer thing and it's attached. That makes it a little bit simpler to handle, I feel like.
Yeah, nope. Sometimes I think like that works. So, you know, one is like attach your resume, your LinkedIn, you know, your quick links that I could just, you know, browse around on, you know, very quickly. Because, you know, sometimes it's easier for me to browse LinkedIn than, you know, go to a resume so I can quickly, you know, see, okay, I recognize these company logos much quicker than like reading out the names.
The text.
Exactly. And I can maybe see references they have. I can look at our mutual connections like that I would probably use to, you know, do reference checks and stuff in the, you know, future. You know, resumes, you know, include that as well, of course. And then, you know, I'm looking for like, okay, why do you want to work here? What role, you know, are you applying to? And, you know, why are you a good, you know, fit for it? And, you know, show me that you've done a little bit of research, you know, on the company that usually, you know, stands out. You know, it's really not that difficult. I think that's for the most part, like what you need to do to kind of stand out from the herd. It's not like a whole lot. The other thing I'll say is like, it's pretty obvious these days when people are using ChatGPT to write emails. Like ChatGPT, even when you try to change the style or tone, there's still like a tone to it, right? Like ChatGPT is essentially like a fancier autocomplete. You know, for a long time, we could generate, you know, 5 or 6, you know, tokens that come out of it. And now, you know, we're able to generate like way more. But I can oftentimes tell if, you know, an email is written, you know, by ChatGPT or it's like very long and has very little substance to it.
Yeah. I get a lot of those like people applying for jobs at Banana Capital, like, love that you've backed so many innovative early stage companies and love that you are an investor in, and it lists like 5 random companies from the page. There's like a lot of fluff words, adjectives. It's just like not really that helpful. I don't really have time to read those long emails, to be honest, when I'm, you know, there's hundreds of emails in there. You almost have to make sure, you got to like hook people pretty quickly too. Like, I feel like any more than 2 paragraphs, any more than like 5 or 6 sentences, you're going to lose people if it's not very enticing. Like, if I'm like, hey, I'm a customer, I want to spend $1 million on SecureFrame, you're probably going to read that email. And if it's like, you tell if it's a serious email, but if there's nothing that really hooks you in the email, like, you're going to kind of move on, because founder of a company, time management is a big thing. You can't spend 20 minutes reading an email from somebody that doesn't go anywhere. So,
yeah, no, 100%.
So the other thing you said was the joke about the LinkedIn open to work. Like, why even joke about that? Like, what's the underlying truth to that joke?
One is like, I want to hire very driven people. I want to hire like go-getters. And I think sometimes like when you put like open to work on like LinkedIn, you're sending this signal like, you know, come to me. I say it as like a joke because I know like a lot of people use it and many people have like found jobs through it. And, you know, people should continue to do what they feel is like best for them.
It's almost like a supply and demand thing. Like if you are very in demand, you're a very good candidate, employee, executive, and you're needing to signal to the market that you're looking for a new job versus the market coming to you and trying to convince you.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I feel like it kind of qualifies you in a bucket that you might not want to be in as a job seeker, potentially.
I think that's the thing. It's like you're hotter, you're in demand. So you don't need to, you know, necessarily put this like thing on your LinkedIn. You know, is that like a real signal? Like, I mean, I think some people like they put it up anyway, even if they're in high demand, like why not get more applications? So that's why I truly do mean that as like a joke, but yeah.
You had some other really good points when we were chatting earlier about just scaling teams. How do you think about, okay, you close whatever amount of money, your business is doing good, and you just start scaling up, you go from 10 to 100 employees, you know, insert whatever scenario you want. How do you personally, and what like lessons have you learned just on how to scale a team effectively?
Yeah, I know everyone says this, but you got to continue to raise the bar with every hire that you make. You know, you constantly hear these analogies of like A players bring in B players and Bs bring in Cs and you know, so on and so forth. And all that stuff is like, you know, very true, right? You really do need to like increase the bar, you know, at all times with your company. You know, as a startup, you only have so many resources. So you have to make sure that the resources and, you know, the headcount and the people that you do bring on are, you know, phenomenal, because those are the people that are responsible, you know, for hiring the next set of people. You always have to be, you know, very involved in hiring. You have to be very rigorous about it. You know, really need to make sure that you have, you know, good management, you know, structures in place. Your managers, you know, are the face of your company to certain employees that they lead, right? So I think, you know, making sure that your managers have good training, that they abide by the culture of the company, that, you know, they're doing a good job of like hiring and bringing on amazing talent and creating like a true performance management culture is important too.
Yeah, you've mentioned before, you're always hiring. You're always trying to find super talented engineers, super talented salespeople, executives. Like, how do you keep doing that? How do you stay on top of that and just constantly be hiring people?
Look, it's like really difficult. I spend so much of my day and so much of my time recruiting great candidates. And it's not just for the candidates that, you know, are hiring or the open roles that we have, you know, today. It's like, okay, you know, I want to talk to, you know, VPs of marketing that I could be hiring a couple of years from now. I want to, you know, build my network for engineering roles that, you know, we're going to open up a year or two from now, right? Oftentimes, like the best candidates, they take like a year or two to, you know, recruit and convince to leave their job, and then the right timing has to open up. So I'm oftentimes just meeting with candidates, getting to know them, staying in touch so that when they are, you know, ready to look for a new role, I have, you know, kind of a good bench of people that I feel comfortable, you know, moving through a process, you know, very quickly at that point. So you do have to spend like a lot of time like networking, knowing who's out on the market, right? And sometimes you have the opportunity to make like an opportunistic hire that maybe you didn't even think you could really get, or they weren't going to be on the market for a while, but you know, now they are, and they reached out to you because you know, they had that relationship that you built with them beforehand, right? So I think all of that is super important. It's probably the number one job that you have to do as the, you know, as a founder or CEO of a company.
I've kind of had another philosophy just in terms of constantly meeting people. When you want to hire a, let's say, CFO, try to just meet the best CFOs in the world, like the top five CFOs. I mean, maybe that's a tall ask, but just, and in terms of raising the bar, like understand what an A+ CFO or head of sales or VP of marketing, engineering, insert whatever. And if you meet five people that are just amazing engineering managers, whether or not you can hire them or not, you know, it's a different story, but then you know what good looks like. So then when you are hiring for the role, you're like, okay, Terry, such a good VP of marketing, like I need to hire someone like her. And it gives you it helps you keep the bar pretty high.
100%. I think that's like a very, you know, common thing that, you know, founders do. And, you know, it's like, you know, ask like some of your investors, you know, for, you know, intros to their portfolio companies and the execs on those teams. And you can get a good variety of that. And I also think it's interesting to like, you know, meet people who maybe like, you know, didn't do so well in the role and like get a retro, you know, from the founder on like, you know, what went wrong there, what would they do better? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily just, you know, honing in on like, you know, what really great looks like, but what, you know, red flags or yellow flags you might want to avoid or, you know, look out for. I think the thing that's even more important than that, which is like pretty common, I think commonly thought of, is, you know, sitting in the role and really understanding like, you know, what you need in that role, right? Like at one point I had to like sit in the engineering seat. I had to sit in the sales seat, the marketing seat, the finance seat, you know, HR, all these things. So I'm like, okay, I know these are the things that this department has a lot of things to deal with or handle. I know that this person's going to need XYZ skill, and you know, because there's like many types, like let's just go into like legal. There's many types of general counsels that you can hire. You can hire someone with a, you know, privacy and security background, which maybe is, you know, much more valuable for, you know, a secure frame. You can hire someone who's just really good at, you know, just general corporate governance, making sure all these sales contracts are negotiated well, right? There's a lot of like flavors you can get there. You can hire a marketer that's amazing at B2B marketing or amazing at B2C marketing, or someone who has a lot of experience selling API products, right? So there's a lot of flavors, and you have to kind of assess, what do you really need? What are the things that you could trade off? Can I teach someone this skill? Or what are the skills that I think are an absolute necessity and not something I really want them to be learning, right? And you have to see, you know, how do these complement the gaps that you have on your current team today, right? You know, talking to those four or five, you know, great CFO candidates, they might have a very different skill set or different thing that makes them valuable to their companies than what might be valuable to SecureFrame or someone else.
And then I think on your point too about understanding all the roles, because maybe you did them or you have done them, you should probably understand how to do the role, understand, like, you know, you're maybe good at this one thing, and then find someone who's better than you at it. That way you can really delegate that and give them full autonomy over the thing, because you know they're going to do a better job than you.
Yeah. And, you know, this is kind of one of the things I talked about earlier is, you know, really, you know, I knew I was going to start a startup at, you know, some point, and I did a lot of planning around it. One of the things, you know, I did was I would, you know, talk to, you know, every leader, every exec at the company, you know, whose desk is everyone going to? I want to talk to that person, understand their job, understand why they're good at it. Why is everyone coming to their desk? Because they're obviously, like, probably very good at, you know, what they do, and, you know, have a really good knowledge base maybe inside what's happening in the company. And I would often, like, you know, I'd go to hire, you know, CFO or VP of finance, and I would ask them, hey, you know, tell me about your day-to-day. Can I just, like, watch what you do? And it's like, you know, showing me Xero and how they're migrating to QuickBooks and, you know, this and that, and, you know, how he's looking to hire this leader. And I'm like, okay, I have, like, a much better understanding of, like, what you do. And and that was, like, you know, very, you know, foundational for me to, you know, understand, like, what to hire for, building my network of those people that I can, you know, call in later, you know, knowing that they're good.
Yeah, you had another kind of on an adjacent framework. You said that finding product market fit is also a 24/7 job. Because some people would say, we found it, this is the moment, we have it forever, and we're good. What exactly do you mean by that?
You know, if you're building a, you know, long-lasting, enduring company, you might have product market fit with a certain market. Like, maybe that market is, like, the first $1 million of business that you have, and now you have to figure out, how do I get to 10 mil? How do I get to 100 mil? And there will be fundamental shifts, you know, in your product, in your ICP, that you will have to expand, you know, over time to better serve that market, right? In the early days, you know, SecureFrame could serve people that just needed SOC 2 and ISO 27001. Now we can serve, you know, a customer that needs any framework, has any, you know, compliance.
Like GDPR, HIPAA, all these acronyms.
Exactly. So, like, there's a lot of stuff that we have to do, you know, to make sure that we, you know, continue to maintain product market fit as we grew, right? And then eventually you have to launch your second and third products, and you want to make sure that you find product market fit there. You know, oftentimes companies do launch, you know, very often they launch a second or third product and it just doesn't grow as fast, or it's not, you know, maybe as good, or doesn't serve their ICP the same way. And that's what I mean. Like, you have to constantly, you know, be looking for product market fit, talking to customers. That, you know, journey never really ends. It's rarely like, hey, we figured it out and boom, we're done.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing to keep in mind, because no one really talks about it. But some of the most successful companies, you think about, I think Rippling is one that's maybe top of mind for a lot of people. Rippling's known for having multiple, I think there's like six kind of core product lines that are, you know, at least a couple million in revenue. And then I think maybe you mentioned ServiceNow earlier. I think that's another one. They have multiple 4, 5, 6 lines that are over like 100 million in ARR, something like very significant like that. So, and ServiceNow is like a, you know, publicly traded, forget the market cap, but one of the biggest enterprise software companies in the world. So, like, when we talk about it, this is a long journey, you know, it's not just product market fit once, it's continuously over time, never ending.
And oftentimes, like, as these companies get larger, you know, they, you know, have to acquire in, you know, these products so that they don't miss out on a market or, you know, something like that. So, you know, there are other ways to, you know, continue, you know, to maintain product market fit, you know, as you grow bigger and, you know, expand. Sometimes they just need a way to bring in that entrepreneurial talent or, you know, that new product.
Yeah, I know there's a couple founders I've met that their philosophy is, we love hiring X founders, or we like acquiring, you know, companies, bring the founders in and like have them lead a team. Just like it's almost like you're running a lot of people will make fun of the running a startup inside another company. In big corporation, maybe it's not quite the same, but I think there are cases where you can give that environment of like, hey, this is your team, you're in charge of it. There's a vision you're trying to help me hit, but you have autonomy. I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Yeah, that's something that I believe in, you know, as well. It's like when we're starting a new product or a new project at SecureFrame, we kind of have like an entrepreneurial engineer or PM that kind of like leads that initiative from the ground up. Like they're responsible for getting the first 10 customers communicating, you know, back and forth and doing some of the initial sales. You know, when we started SecureFrame, it's like, you know, okay, I had to, you know, spend some time like coding. Then I would, you know, get, you know, jump into a demo and then, you know, demo goes well and they want an order form generated. And then they became a customer and now I'm doing some customer support and building more features based on their feedback. And then I take another sales call and, you know, just having a week of constant, like 2 to 3 calls a day between customers and prospects allowed us to build a lot quicker. And we didn't have a Jira or, you know, project management tool at the time. It's like, okay, customer says something, let's code it right now. Let's just mock it up in Figma in 10 minutes and push it through, right? So there was a very, very quick feedback loop. So we try to recreate, you know, those effects when we're launching new things at SecureFrame.
Trying to think, I think we hit on all the big topics we wanted to hit on. This is an awesome conversation. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, of course. And thanks for having me, Turner. Excited to be a part of it.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with Shrav Mehta, founder and CEO of SecureFrame. If you don't want to miss future episodes of The Peel, subscribe to my newsletter, The Split, in the show notes, and you'll get new episodes plus the transcripts in your inbox. If you want to support the show, share this episode with your favorite founder starting to think through getting SOC 2 compliant. Thanks again to Shrav for coming on, and thanks to you for listening. I hope you enjoyed. See you next episode.